What's in this podcast?
That's a good start as any. We have got Professor Paul Wignall of Leeds University, who's an expert on mass extinctions, talking about mass extinctions.
Anyone in particular, or just all of them?
Well, we got a bit on the KT or KPG. Make your own mind up what you want to call it, which is the meteorite and lava killing off the dinosaurs. And then we've also got a bit about the Permo-Triassic, the PT event, which Paul is the, I'd say, would I don't know if he'd be the authority. Well, I don't know much about how many researchers there are looking at that, but he is one of the go-to guys for this event, so it's really good that he's talking to us. And then we kind of covered like what mass extinctions are and how many there are and what kind of things you need to, oh, why am I telling you all what's in it? You could just all listen. So, since last time we spoke to you, Laura, what's been going on?
I've been doing lots of work. I submitted a paper.
Yes, do tell, what's that about?
So basically, I think I've mentioned before on the podcast that a lot of what I'm interested in my work is macroevolution. So that's really big patterns in evolution over long time scales that can be applied to lots and lots of different life forms, species, anything really. So things that we might be interested in if we're looking at macroevolution might be the rate that things are evolving, so how fast kind of different features of animals evolve over time, or the best way that we could model how those features change sort of statistically. And then things like when and why animals might go extinct. So those are the kinds of things that we'd look at over really broad timescales. If you're a biologist and you actually want to look at those kinds of things, you can go out and you can get the species that you're interested in, and you can look at it and you can see how it behaves, and you can take its DNA and you can find out pretty much anything about it really. But obviously, paleontologists, we only have fossils, so we can't really do that. So we might actually know very little about the species that we're interested in. So we can't measure very much. So the quality of data isn't anywhere near as good as it would be if you were looking at things that are alive now. So what my paper is about really is if paleontologists do the same kind of big analyses that I was talking about, macroevolutionary ones. If they want to do the same ones as the biologists, how good does their fossil information actually have to be for them to get a proper result? So it's really about kind of testing the quality of information that you need as a paleontologist. What do you need to get out of your fossil? What do you need to know to be able to actually say anything about macroevolutionary patterns?
Okay, and where in the publication process is this paper then?
So it's only been submitted, so it could get bounced straight back to me at this stage, or it could get sent to review, and then if it gets sent to review, I'll have corrections and things to do. Oh, police car. So at the moment it's fingers crossed stage. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, hope you got it done. Have you seen any papers that have been published recently? Anyone? Any good papers? Maybe about chasmotaspidids?
I don't know. Oh yeah, no, there was this really good one
Did it come
by
out
a
on
guy who
the...
it was Dave Marshall, I think.
Oh, that sounds like a good paper. Why don't we talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, what was that paper about?
I heard it was about a load of new species of chasmotaspidids that some wonderful guy found in Siberia.
I think we've talked about chasmotaspidids before, but what are they? Remind me.
They're kind of like horseshoe crabs, so Ziphiurans, and they're sort of kind of like Eurypterids, sea scorpions, which are now extinct, come kind of in between them in the evolutionary tree. And yeah, just a few of those in Siberia, new species that I described, and that's been published finally after 5 years of my part-time research. So I'm very, very happy. Although I haven't actually read it, I'm terrified of like spotting a spelling mistake or something, Because like I've gone through this paper about 6 or 7 times, and I'm just dreading the moment when someone says something to me like, "Oh, Dave, you forgot to mention this specimen, or you misquoted someone here," and so I just haven't looked.
You'd hope by now that after review and everything, that most of that stuff should have been picked up.
Yeah, I'd hope so,
I'm sure
but
it's
knowing
fine.
me, probably not. But hey, no one's gonna read it anyway because no one really knows what chasmotaspidids are. But if
I'll read it.
you won't. You say you will.
I will. I'll go read it tomorrow.
It's
I'll let you
about
know what I think. I
30
won't tell
pages
you if there's
long.
a, I won't tell you if there's a spelling mistake.
Right, thanks. But yeah, if you are interested in any kind of arthropody stuff, please give it a read. Let me know
Did
what
you
you
get
think.
to name the new species?
Yeah, I did.
What is it called?
Well, there's more than one.
Oh, there's lots.
Well, there's new genera, so that's the next level up from species. So kind of like Homo in Homo sapiens, that's the genus. And so I named. God, you're putting me on the spot here. I should really know this. There was some that like I had to change the names of. So we've now got Heteraspis stormeri, Dvolichiaspis menneri, Scritiaspis andersoni, Nalliostaspis bergstromi, and the other one that I forgot. No, that's it. I think that's it.
Is that it?
Yeah, that's
Those
it.
are all good names.
Thank you very much. A lot of them are in Russian. So my pronunciations are all off. Sorry if there's any Russian listeners. We have been downloaded a couple of times in Russia, actually.
Yeah.
So hello to you.
I hope we have Russian listeners. There's some good paleontology in Russia.
There's a lot of good paleontology in Russia, so hoping to get there. Well, it's the biggest country in the world, so you'd hope
Yeah.
there's quite a lot. Other than that, I've got my marching orders to go back on the oil rigs. So, as it currently stands, in 4 days' time, well, when this episode will be released, I should be on an oil rig. So, hello from the North Sea.
How long for this time?
Well, that's you can never really tell. I've been told it should be perhaps a week, but if it gets delayed any further, or if I have a delay in coming off, if there's fog, for example, and the helicopters can't fly, which happens quite a lot, then I might get stuck out there. But we've got the Paleontological Association meeting that we're supposed to be live streaming, and I've got all the equipment here, and so I really hope that I'm off in time to do that, because if not, then we won't be able to live stream it. It's something that I've spoken to Christian Klug, who's running the conference, and he's saying that if we can't get me out there, then we won't be able to do the live stream. But we should still be able to record all the talks and just get it out probably a few weeks after the event. So you'll still get to see them all, but just not live. So sorry in advance if I can't make it, but I'll be stuck on the
Fingers
rig.
crossed.
Having no fun. Other than that, just should say that after a year of being with us, that John's no longer part of the PaleoCast team. So thanks for his work in that time, and best of luck to him and all the things that he's doing. He's still got his blog that you can follow, and he's always posting on Twitter. So yeah, keep following his stuff. Other than that, I think we've probably talked a bit too long for this introduction, and yeah, it's a fantastic one. So I hope you all enjoy it, and please send us your thoughts. Post on our Facebook and Twitter accounts, so we'd love to hear what you think of it. So Paul, thank you very much for joining us. I'd just like to start off with really getting to understand how you ended up as an expert on mass extinctions. Would you say that's
Yes.
You are, yeah.
Yeah, I guess so.
So how did you get into it?
That's quite a good question, actually. Yes, after I finished my PhD and I went on to be a postdoc, and I was looking at animals that live in very low oxygen conditions, and at that point I realised that that actually applies at the Permian and Triassic boundary. So it's very indirect way of getting interested in it. Now, this is 25 years ago, and there's not many people looking at mass extinctions, and apart from the famous KT mass extinction. So I just thought, yeah, this seems interesting. So I sort of moved in at that point.
So what did you cut your teeth on?
My PhD was on Jurassic fossils and late Jurassic fossils down in Dorset and in northern France, and looking at what they could say about conditions at the time. Okay.
Right, so first of all, when we're talking about extinctions, I'd quite like to define how we know they occur. So we have, I hope we'd all understand that the fossil record is really incomplete, both in terms of the favourable preservation of certain organisms, that you only get the hard parts, and that certain environments are more likely to form rocks than other ones. So how can we tell when extinctions occur? Is it simply taken from the last known occurrence of a fossil?
Yes, that's basically it. I mean, we've known for a long time that there were periods of time when we seem to lose a lot of fossils. In fact, I think the mass extinctions are so big and so many things die that it was one of the things that, in fact, stood out almost immediately when people started studying the fossil record. So even back in Charles Darwin's day, they realised there were these big breaks and big gaps in the fossil record. At the time, they thought it may be, as you were just explaining, it may be just poor quality fossil record at those times, and so we sort of had this sort of blackout of fossils, and then suddenly when we see some new fossils again, they've changed. But in more recent years, with just improved collecting, we now realise that in fact mass extinctions are genuine phenomena where things disappear, lots of things disappear in a very short space of time.
So how do you actually define a mass extinction? Is it just a matter of abundance, a certain threshold amount of animals go or plants or organisms go extinct at a certain time, or are there any other criteria that define it?
That's certainly one of them. Yes, obviously a lot of things have to die to make it a mass extinction, and just where you sort of make the cutoff is somewhat sort of debatable, I guess. But also the key things with mass extinctions are that they should essentially be global, so they should affect everything everywhere. And they should also affect a whole range of environments as well. So, your classic mass extinctions, they're known as the Big Five, the biggest five extinction events that we have. They affect all life everywhere in all habitats. So, they're global devastations.
And is there any type of time constraint on them? Can you have a mass extinction that lasts 50 million years, or does it have to be a really short?
Yeah, it has to be short, which is only short to a geologist, in the sense that we think a million years is a short period of time. So, all mass extinctions are less than a million years, I would say. I'm not sure if that's actually written or defined in writing anyway, but if it's when you start spreading things out, then you're just talking about the fossil record and history, basically. But when, mass extinctions are very short and sharp.
And so in order to ascertain whether or not a mass extinction has occurred, which you first have to look at all of the data for all of the species, just so you can see when one's gone extinct. You've really got to know the fossil record to understand what's disappeared.
Yes.
Has that been quantified in any way?
It has. I mean, it was a lot of the work dates to the early 1980s. There was two guys in Chicago University, Raup and Sepkoski, and they, particularly Jack Sepkoski, he did a sort of a compendium of the known fossil record. So he spent years and years in the library compiling all this information that's published on fossils. And then from that data set, we then got a feel for when things appeared, when things disappeared, and were able to compile extinction graphs, or extinction rates through time. And that's what really sort of started off our study of mass extinctions. Although before Sepkoski was even working, the big mass extinctions, as I was saying, have been known since the 19th century, these big, big declines in diversity.
And so what were the major findings of his work?
Back then, yes, he found he sort of emphasized, we knew about the sort of two big ones, but he sort of really stressed that in fact there were other major extinctions as well. There's five, big five that we have, and it sort of clarified those big five extinctions, and also in fact identified a series of lesser extinction events. And back in those days, there was this debate about whether extinction events were spaced every 26 million years, and then people got excited by this idea that there's some sort of periodicity to life on Earth, and there's something maybe out in the sort of solar system or galaxy which is causing these rises and falls of extinctions. Those original ideas have gone now, because we now date things better, and we know in fact they're much more randomly spaced, so we don't worry so much about this supposed cyclicity to extinctions.
And so have there been any other large-scale changes? Are there more extinctions as you go on through time, or are they decreasing?
They seem to be decreasing, actually. If you go back in the sort of the start of animal life, sort of in the Cambrian, 550-odd million years ago, from that point onwards, for the first few hundred million years, we seem to have quite regular extinction events, of which one or two are quite big. But since the in the last 200 million years, extinctions have had relatively few. There's obviously the famous one with the dinosaur extinction, but that's about the only major one of the last 200 million years.
So why is that? Are ecosystems a lot more stable, or are we just having less meteorite impacts? Or
it's a very important question. We don't really know. Yes, you could say it seems that life on Earth is becoming more resilient. One of the things that mass extinctions do is they often devastate the base of the food chain. The plankton in the oceans often suffer a crash during mass extinctions, and that's hardly happened since in the last 200 million years. Only the KT event 65 million years ago is the only time when you could say we really had a sort of catastrophic collapse of the base of the food chain.
Okay, so this KT event, which is Cretaceous, which is abbreviated to K, isn't it?
Yes, confusingly. Yeah.
There's a lot of periods that start with C. So
that's right, yeah.
Yeah, so Cretaceous is K.
Yeah.
And it's also Cretaceous and Tertiary.
Yes, that's where the abbreviation comes from, although nowadays we tend to often call the Paleogene now. The Tertiary, the early part of the Tertiary, is most commonly called the Paleogene. So it's often called the KPG event these days, but it's become famous as the KT event.
Right, so this boundary is also the boundary between the Mesozoic and the Cenozoic eras as well. Okay,
yeah.
So do we know what actually caused it?
I guess you could say so. Yes, this is the incredibly fascinating event, because it has two main potential culprits, and it's been sort of a very long ongoing debate in the scientific community. There's both culprits, I think, are very famous. There's this gigantic meteorite strike in Mexico, and then there's an enormous amount of volcanism going on at the same time in India, and so you have two completely independent potential perpetrators of this crime. And so it's the big debate is which is the most important, and can we work out is one the main culprit, is one just sort of a complete red herring and is nothing to do with it. So that the debate has raged for since 1980, I guess, since the original idea about the meteorite impact was first discovered. Probably for the majority of people, it's the meteorite impact seems a significant, if not the dominant, role in this mass extinction. But always at the back of your mind is the fact that we have this enormous amount of volcanism going on as well.
So what evidence do we have for this meteorite impact?
We have the very big evidence in the form of a gigantic impact crater, which is...
I guess I'd give it away, yeah.
Which is great. But when the idea was originally proposed back in 1980, it was based on much more cryptic, almost sort of forensic-like evidence of enrichment of a trace metal called iridium, which in boundary clays, and you don't get much of that at all in the Earth's crust, but you do get it in meteorites. So it was the introduction of a sort of a thin sprinkling of iridium on the surface of the planet was the original sort of evidence.
So the iridium-rich meteorite would have hit the Earth pretty much and spread.
Vaporised. And then all the dust was just spread all the way around the world. and then just rains down as a fine rain of dust and then gets into the sediment that way.
Okay, and that's kind of all over the Earth?
It is, it's global, yeah.
Yeah. All right, and so with so many dust particles in the air, was that the cause or was it the actual impact?
The actual cause, yes, it's an interesting, again, there's a discussion about what would actually be the actual cause of the extinction, and certainly the first thing that a gigantic impact does is it vaporizes, turns the target rock to dust, and so there's so much energy involved. In fact, you turn a lot of it to little sort of liquid globules of rock, tiny little spheres of rock, which are very hot, of course. And so then as they rain back down to Earth, that the heat from those basically bakes the surface of the Earth. You'd have a pulse of maybe lasting several hours, of which you'd sort of have temperatures equivalent to being inside an oven on the surface of the Earth. So,
and is that just in the area of where the meteorite?
No, again, global, because it's the actual ejector, as it's called, gets blown back out, sort of just into outer space, but then it settles back on the outer atmosphere of the Earth, and then sinks back to Earth and radiating its heat back down to the surface. So it becomes particularly bad for things on land. If you're in open, exposed on land, then it's terrible because you've been cooked. The sea's not so bad because you've got the ocean waters will absorb the heat and it won't get that much hotter. So that's one immediate and direct consequence of a giant meteorite impact. The other consequence is a lot of the finest material just stays in the atmosphere for over several years and gradually falls back to Earth. And so you get very dull. You talk about at the time when these ideas were proposed back in the 1980s, we had this concept of a sort of nuclear winter for any potential sort of after effects of a nuclear war. And it was argued that we may have a similar effect from a giant impact as well, where you just put so much dust and ash into the atmosphere that it just makes the place dark for years and years.
So the actual KT event, you lost the dinosaurs, you lost the pterosaurs, but you also lost things like ammonites in the sea.
Yep.
How were they affected? Was it just the productivity in the oceans?
Yeah, there's two possibilities. Probably going back to the idea of global darkness, you shut down photosynthesis, so the plankton in the oceans, the base of the food chain, will die temporarily. And so then the knock-on effects is things further up the food chain will die as well because the food has gone. So that's the most likely cause of death. The other thing as well is the impact also hits a rock called gypsum, which is has a lot of sulfate in it. It's made of sulfate. So that, when you vaporise that, you get a lot of sulfuric acid. And so it's argued that you would have had this sort of pulse of sulfuric acid raining onto the surface of the oceans as well, giving you a sort of a little brief pulse of acidification, which again is not good, particularly for anything that makes shells in the sea.
And something else that would feed into that are the volcanic eruptions that you mentioned, producing lots of sulfur and a lot of dust in the atmosphere as well.
Yes, volcanic eruptions do. This is part of why it's hard to disentangle the two effects, because giant volcanic eruptions do very similar things to meteorite impact. So they blast a lot of gases into the atmosphere, of which sulfur dioxide, this acidic gas, is a very large component of the gases. And also carbon dioxide comes out as well from volcanoes, and that's a greenhouse gas. You get nasty halogens as well, which chlorine and fluorine will come out of volcanoes. So all these, it's all the effects of these nasty gases are all being thrown into the equation and, somehow having a bad effect.
And I'm guessing the evidence for these volcanic eruptions is a lot easier to identify than it was for the meteorite, if you just got big areas.
Yes,
of
giant smoking guns, yes. A large part of Western and particularly northwestern India is still covered in these. Is made of these lavas, the Ghats province, and so on. The Deccan traps, they're called, and they cover a vast area of India today.
So, looking at the events as a whole, how bad was it?
Extremely bad. It's the worst. It's the worst. The worst event of, as I was saying, the last 200 million years. So it was extremely bad, I guess. Some of these extinction ideas and scenarios are so bad, in fact, you start to wonder how anything survived. If you have this blast of cooking everything on the planet and then you're freezing everything in darkness for years and years, how did anything survive this? Maybe sometimes extinction scenarios are just too bad, but you do have to kill a lot of things. I mean, you have to make everything, you have to make things on Earth extremely bad to wipe out so many things.
So what kind of percentage of life did we lose?
Well, we know we have a good appreciation for sort of at the not so much at the species level, because it's a bit hard to know what happened to every single species because there's so many of them. But some of the larger groups, like obviously the dinosaurs and many of the major families of birds and pterosaurs, we know they disappear. And we've, using that information, we can sort of extrapolate that we may have lost about sort of 70% of the world's species at that time. And in terms of individuals, of course, it will be 99% of the world's individuals, because to kill a species, you have to kill every single last member of that species. And so that means that those things that survived, although they survived, you can bet that they lost most of the individuals as well. So it would be a very empty world.
And so the diversity of life that we can see today is really just the remnants of what diversified out of that extinction.
Yeah, I mean, famously, the mammals were the group that benefited most from this extinction, and so we are the beneficiaries of the KT extinction. The mammal groups radiated. It's interesting, the extinction of the dinosaurs was also a terrible time for the mammals on Earth as well. It's by far the worst mammal extinction of all time, but the crucial thing is it didn't kill all mammals, and so those few groups that survived have then gone on to found all the main mammal groups that we see today.
And so, despite losing so much life in this event, it's not the biggest extinction event that's ever happened.
No.
So you look at the Permo-Triassic
event.
Could you tell us a bit about that one?
Yes, I mean, this event is 252 million years ago. It's known as one of the Big Five, of the Big Five mass extinctions, and it's the biggest. And so we think that we may have lost about 95% of species at this time. At the end of the Permian, and sort of the sort of extinctions are in a narrow band across the Permian and into the Triassic, actually, so it's often known as the PT mass extinction. And it, like true mass extinctions, it killed everything everywhere. So we see devastation on land, the life on land, the life plants and animals on land, and all life in the ocean as well. There's very few things survived unscathed from this event.
Do we know its possible causes?
We have a very likely culprit, which is this huge volume of lava that came out in Siberia. So it's known as the Siberian Traps. They've been eroded a bit, but they're kind of still there today in northwest Siberia, and around a town called Norilsk is kind of in the middle of the Siberian Traps. And a lot of West Siberia is still covered in the lava that came out at that time.
So did these volcanic eruptions have pretty much the same effect as the ones at the Cretaceous-Tertiary event?
Yes, I mean, there's every time these giant volcanic provinces, such as the Siberian Traps and the Deccan Traps, they're very, very, very frequently they're associated with big climatic changes and big extinction events as well. And the Siberian Traps is probably the best example of this. From our evidence that we get from various lines, from fossils and also from the chemistry of the rocks, we think the most obvious thing that happens is a very rapid rise of temperature at the same time as the eruptions happen. And so, therefore, we link those two together. We think the eruptions are driving or triggering a rapid temperature rise at the end of the Permian.
If we look at all the animals that are alive today, quite a lot are able to live in hot conditions. So why is it that you lose the animals or the organisms due to the temperatures? Wouldn't the ones that are acclimatized be able to survive this kind of event?
It's a good point, yeah. I mean, it's first of all, the main temperature rise on its own is only really bad for things living at high latitudes, living in cooler conditions, because you essentially shift all the warmer conditions further north and south. And so the very high polar latitudes will lose their habitat, in effect. The temperature rise is actually worse for life in the oceans, and that's because it's a sort of a consequential effect of temperature rise in the oceans, is you get less oxygen in the oceans. And in fact, the direct cause of death in the oceans at this time seems to be from the lack of oxygen. It's known as anoxia at the time. But also, that goes sort of hand in hand with temperature. And it's a really unfortunate coincidence that as life gets warmer, as you warm things up, the amount of oxygen that we need and animals need goes up, the requirements for oxygen, our whole metabolism speeds up. And yet, as you get warmer conditions, you get less oxygen available in water, you dissolve less oxygen in water. And so the two are going in opposite directions, and so it becomes really bad, basically, for life in the oceans. For life on land, actually, it's it is harder to envisage just temperature doing it. And so these days we think it may also be implicating ozone destruction as well from volcanism. And ozone destruction, therefore, once you destroy ozone, you increase the UV radiation, and so you harm plants. And then as soon as you start making plants die off, then the consequences are bad for animals and so on. And volcanic eruptions, as mentioned, they release gases which are good at destroying ozone or suppressing ozone, such as halogens, chlorine and fluorine. And there's possibility that other nasty gases come out with some of this volcanism as well. So that's a different effect, and will be particularly bad for photosynthesis on land.
So when we compare it to the KT event, was it just that there was a lot more lava erupted at the Permo-Triassic?
Yes, quite a lot more, I guess. But it's similar, actually. The Deccan traps are not that small, not that much smaller than the Siberian traps. And we actually know that in terms of the rate of eruptions, the real peak of eruptions of the Deccan traps was right at the KT boundary, right at the mass extinction as well. So it's very comparable to the Siberian traps, which is why it makes it so hard to untangle and unravel what's happening at the KT, because you have a giant impact and a real peak of massive volcanism at that time as well.
So with just the one big eruption in the Permo-Triassic, was it just a pretty quick event?
It's actually in detail. When you study the event in detail, there's actually two pulses to the extinction. And so you have, they're about 200,000 years apart, as best as we can judge. And so we think that they are two pulses, two big pulses of the Siberian eruptions, basically. So yeah, they come out in two parts.
So what's the evidence for that?
Although it's a long way from Siberia, but we have the best fossil record at this time comes from South China, when a lot of fossil collecting has been done there, and we now see within the rocks there that in fact things disappear at two different levels, and they're separated by a certain amount of rock, and we have some good age dates from those rocks, because there's volcanic ashes have interbedded with the sediments, and we can date minerals in the volcanic ashes very well, and so we have a nice time frame for what was happening then.
And so was it a case of the first event took life down to its knees and the second one finished it off, kind of thing?
It's fascinating, actually. Something I look at specifically is in that particular interval, and in fact between the two pulses, it's a funny world, actually, between the two pulses. The first pulse has sort of killed off about sort of 60-70% of life. But things, there is a slight sign of recovery in between. It's long enough for some new species to start appearing. But it's still an odd world. There's still some things are struggling. Some reefs have gone for good, and we're getting some strange microbial structures. It's kind of trying to bounce back after the first extinction. And then the second one, just that was the real sort of blow, basically. It just devastated life. And it's then a very long period of time before things start to recover.
So at this event, what kind of things went extinct and what kind of things did we see after?
Yeah, the end Permian mass extinction is, I guess, not as famous as other extinctions, partly because the victims are so obscure. I mean, they've been dead a long time and they're not groups which are sort of, if you like, famous. So on land, we have a whole bunch of... They used to get called animals. It used to get called mammal-like reptiles, which is a weird-sounding term. But the sort of relatively primitive vertebrates on land, which included some sort of relatively large herbivores, big sort of lumbering things called the pariasaurs, which is early reptile-like group. And then we have other groups. The pariasaurs were being eaten by a group of large predators called the Gorgonopsids, which are impressive-looking beasts as well. And all these groups disappear. There's the group known as the Cynodonts. They suffer losses, but they survive across the boundary. Ultimately gave rise to a group called the Mammals, which we're more familiar with, and so on. So, the animals on land were rather unusual looking, I guess, they weren't the sort of swift sort of dinosaurs and mammals that are more familiar that come along later. In the seas, the groups that disappear is we lose, the most famous group to disappear is the trilobites, which are well-known fossils. They were kind of not particularly common by the Permian anyway, but they failed to survive the boundary. The dominant sort of shellfish on the seabed that time was a group known as the brachiopods, which we still have a few living in the oceans today, but the end of the Permian is the last time they were ever abundant and dominant on the seafloors, and so they suffered terribly. As a group known as the crinoids, which again we can still find them today, you've seen them in the deep sea, but they're not a very particularly common group today. But up to the end of the Permian, they were incredibly abundant. The seas would have been full of crinoids. These are things that sort of they're sort of echinoderms. They had a stalk and then a sort of head with arms on them, which they collected food. So they're called sea lilies, the modern ones. And so anyway, the majority of crinoids disappear at the end of the Permian. In the surface water of the oceans, we have a group known as the radiolarians, which are, again, we're still around today. They're little tiny little planktonic organisms, single cell. They excrete a little tiny skeleton of silica, and they're very common fossils. And they have a very long fossil record, in fact. But the end of the Permian is by far their worst extinction event. And in fact, they almost disappear from the oceans for several million years after this event.
And what kind of... Did we get any weird... wonderful forms that diversified immediately after the Permian? Because you got all of this available ecospace now that everything's died.
Yeah.
So the diversification, was that pretty quick, and you get loads of...
You do. Fossils are quite common after the extinction event. It's just more or less all the same thing. So in the seas, you have lots of little tiny snails. They become very common after the event. And you get a type of bivalve, which are loosely called flat clams, which the name describes, are little sort of flat discs, which were just lying around on the seabed as well. On land, there's an animal, I think a dicynodont called Lystrosaurus, which was a herbivore, medium-sized herbivore, which remarkably survives this extinction. It's quite a large animal, actually, and it becomes incredibly widespread for about a million years after this event. I think partly because it has the world to itself, so it does what it wants. It goes wanders around eating where it wants. And there was nothing, as far as we know, eating it, because it was quite a large animal, and there were no large predators survived this extinction either. So it's a very unusual ecosystem with lacking top predators. And so, fine, if you're a herbivore, you just proliferate.
One thing that I remember from my MSc, I think, do you get a lot of mushrooms?
You do, yes. You get right at the extinction, you get this thing called a fungal spike, and we can have a very nice fossil record of the spores and pollen of plants, because that preserves very well in sedimentary rocks. And one of the things that crops up at the boundary is this sudden spike of fungal spores, which looks like therefore must have been a lot of fungi around at this time, but just at the extinction, so it kind of fades away after into the early Triassic as well.
So with the mollusks and fungus really doing pretty well, it sounds pretty slimy.
Yes, and there's lots of microbes around in the seas and things, yes. It would be a weird world. It would be very unfamiliar to us if we were able to go back and look at it.
So what kind of things survive mass extinctions? What kind of qualities do you need to be able to get through it?
As a generality, you need, which is a good word, I guess you have to be a generalist, so it gives you a chance to sort of at least find somewhere that you can survive. Things that are widespread often survive, which goes hand in hand with being some sort of generalist. You don't have to be too specialised. There's bound to be an element of luck involved as well. For the life in the oceans, I think the ability to survive high temperatures and survive a lack of oxygen, particularly in the bottom waters, was a good attribute. It's interesting, one of the groups that survived the end Permian extinction pretty well were the fish, and I think that's because they swim in surface waters. They're not so, and the surface waters are probably amongst the least affected of the sort of environments of the oceans at that time. The deeper waters, anything in deep water died, but living in surface waters seems to have been okay.
So if we look at the animals and plants that we have alive today, could we suggest the likely candidates for surviving a mass extinction?
Yes, and some will be very obvious, like sort of rats and things and cockroaches, sort of lots of hardy insects will survive. Things with a sort of rapid reproduction rate is always a good idea, because you can replace your losses very quickly. So often that means small things as well. The large animals have a much slower sort of reproductive rate and turnover, and so it's not a good idea to be large if you want to survive a mass extinction.
And things that are more likely to go extinct?
Yeah, the large animals, those things that just live in sort of small areas, sort of more specialised animals. Often ecosystems which are quite complex and sort of where everything interacts, like reefs, for example. Reefs are a very complex ecosystem, and they always suffer badly at mass extinctions. I think they're one of those ecosystems where you start to kill one or two things, you sort of, then the whole thing collapses. Once you've removed a few species, the whole system will collapse. And potential things in tropical rainforests as well, I would predict wouldn't do very well. Simply if you remove sort of things known as keystone species or key species, then there's sort of a cascade of extinctions will follow on from that.
So it's like removing a card from a
house of cards. Yeah.
House of cards.
Yeah.
Okay, so these two are just examples of some of the big five, possibly even big six. There's quite a lot of extinction events. Are the other ones caused by similar processes, or like meteorites and global warming, or are there any other causes?
Most extinctions, the vast majority, with one or two exceptions, coincide with these giant volcanic provinces. So every time one of these giant volcanic provinces goes off, there's often some sort of climatic change, and there very frequently is an extinction as well. And there is an interesting exception, which was known as the End-Ordovician extinction, which is about 430 million years ago. This is a very old extinction, which doesn't have any obvious link to volcanism at all. It actually coincides with a very short, sharp glaciation, so a snap of cooling at that time, and big changes in the ocean circulation as a result. So, yes, that's an interesting exception to the rule.
So how would the cooling affect the organisms? Is it just the opposite of...
Yeah, I think it occurs very fast. I think change is bad for anything. So I think the world changes very fast and sort of lurches from a more normal world, and then suddenly became very cold. And certainly the ocean, that seems to have a fundamental effect on ocean circulation, the distribution of sort of warm belts, and the way the ocean's temperature stratification changed as well. And so I think a lot of habitats disappeared as a result of this dramatic change. It was good for things at high latitudes. You see this sudden specialist sort of animals in the sea, which had just lived in polar waters. They just suddenly turn up at the equator at this time, and they do fine. But things that were at the equator have gone. So I guess the whole world got rather cold.
And are there any events that have no obvious cause, or are there some that have like five or six potential causes?
That's a good question. Yeah, there's always ideas out there for all these extinction events. This one at the end of the Ordovician I just mentioned, to me there's no obvious cause for that as to why the world suddenly went cooler. I mean, it makes you wonder whether you should look at the sun or something and think maybe there was a cool phase of the sun. Some are very enigmatic still. For the majority, it's all about the debate these days, and the sort of scientific arguments are all about going from a lot of volcanism, a lot of lava emission, and then saying, OK, how does that then cause global devastation and climate change? So it's a lot of debates about the gases that come out and how those gases, what they do in the atmosphere and how they're bad.
So if you're looking at these atmospheric processes and solar processes, is it better to think of studying mass extinctions as a kind of geological, geochemical, astronomical field rather than a biological field? Or is the ways that you can link back the kind of animals that went extinct, can they tell you about the extinction?
Very much so. I mean, it's one of the reasons I like the field is it draws on evidence from a whole range of different sciences. So you need to have an understanding of the atmosphere and understanding of chemistry. But the fossils and the biological angle is crucial as well. First of all, they tell you that it is an extinction. They also tell you when the extinction happened, so you know where to look when you're studying the rocks. But also the way that things have gone extinct can tell you a lot about the nature of the extinction. So, for example, if we see a lot of extinction of things at the base of the food chain, you start thinking about things that affect photosynthesis. Things like acidification in the oceans, the best evidence for that is to look for, do you preferentially lose animals which wouldn't like acidification, which are those that secrete shells, which are easily dissolved, and so you start looking at the preferential losses at the time and say, right, does this suggest that we're losing acid-intolerant things?
Can we utilise this information in the modern day? Can it tell us about the future, what to expect with climate change and ocean acidification?
We can. I mean, it's the obvious thing. It's very useful, I guess, for the modern day, because obviously there's a lot of effort in trying to predict what's going to happen in the next 100 years in terms of climate change. And so, of course, all these changes have happened before, and they've happened in a much bigger way before. Whatever happened at the end of the Permian is just dwarfs anything that's happening today so far. And I suspect we're not going to recreate the end Permian anytime soon. But it's useful to show that, in a way, there's always this idea of having a sort of a nice benign Gaia-like planet that's sort of self-regulating and doesn't oscillate too much. But the mass extinctions show you, in fact, there are times when you can actually have terrible things happen to the planet. The end Permian mass extinction is fascinating because it's 5-6 million years before you even see the sort of hints of recovery after that extinction. So we really have clobbered life on Earth, and it takes a very long time to get back from that.
Do you think we're headed into another mass extinction? I mean, we always hear about all these species going extinct and the critically endangered. Yeah. Is this signs that we're into another mass extinction, or is this just because we're looking at the whole ecosystem and not through the bias of the fossil record, and so we can see kind of like the background extinction?
Yeah. No, I think we are. I mean, there's a uniquely sort of human-style extinction going on at the moment in terms of hunting things or overfishing things to extinction and destroying habitat for arable land and for farming land and so on, which has no parallel in the past, of course. This is just one species directly going out and destroying things for its own benefit. But we might... A lot of the sort of the worries of climate change is actually more analogous to things in the past, because this... We're now the potential now that we might be causing extinctions not directly but by our indirect consequences of putting carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is the main link, and that has clearly happened in the past. There has been periods of rapid warming driven by sudden emission of CO2 into the atmosphere.
How do the extinctions that we see today compare to the ones in the past?
The big difference between what's happening today and in the geological past is that it's happening fast, basically. Everything that we're doing today is an absolute... we'd never resolve it in a geological record. It would be on a bedding plane, because it's so... 100 years, we can barely resolve 100 years' time in the geological record. And so we know a lot of the severe crises of the past have happened over periods of thousands of years, which we think is very fast. But on a human timescale, if something happened in 10,000 years, we think, well, that's incredibly slow. It's way beyond our lifespan. But in fact, it's incredibly fast to the Earth. But nowadays, of course, any changes in the 21st century are going to be... Essentially, we're talking instantaneous on a geological timescale, and we don't have anything really analogous to that.
Are we going to recreate one of these past mass extinctions in the future?
Potentially, but not anytime soon. I think I think we are definitely changing things at the moment in terms of climate change, but we're not getting to the point of an end Permian mass extinction. Potentially we might be there in 5,000 or 6,000 years' time. It takes a long time to change the nature of the ocean, sort of the temperatures of the ocean. Oceans heat up very slowly, and ocean circulation changes incredibly slowly as well. We might be able to achieve that in... We don't want to do it, but we might be able to achieve that in the next few hundred years. We might start seeing things changing, and maybe in 5,000-6,000 years' time, we might be looking at what were incredibly lethal oceans of the end Permian might be starting to reoccur. And then you run into the sort of rather philosophical debate about, are you worried about what the world will be like in 5,000 years' time? Nobody we know will be around. Nobody we would consider ourselves related to will be around as well. So then, yeah, is it an issue? You can think about it.
I'm not going to answer.
No, no. Do you care what the world will be like in 5,000 years' time?
I hope paleocast will still be going.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if we went back 5,000 years from where we are now, it's long before Alexander the Great or anybody like that. I mean, it's a matter of not being able to conceive of long periods of time like that, really. It's the strange thing about being a geologist, of course, that we just have two outlooks in life, don't we? We have our own sort of our everyday, day-to-day, month-to-month existence, and then we have our millions of years. A million years is quite quick, but we can't reconcile, I don't think, in our minds, the bit in between.
Mm-hmm. Well, ignoring the human element, then, would it be inevitable that we have a mass extinction in the future? Is it just something that happens if you've got a complex biological system?
I find it hard to answer, actually, because 200 million years ago, yes, we're back to the point about the sort of increased resilience of life on Earth, I think. It's particularly the sort of life in the oceans and the plankton that we have in the oceans now at the base of the food chain seem very tough. And so, I can't answer it. Nobody will be able to answer it in any time soon, whether we'll actually see any sort of collapse of productivity. I mean, a mass extinction is... We will definitely see extinctions and bad things will happen, but mass extinction is enormous, and it's really the entire food chains are being destroyed, and everything from the base of that food chain to the top is being affected, and we're losing huge numbers of species from that. And so they are a big thing. But yeah, I'm sure we'll see severe extinctions, but mass extinction is really quite hard to do. Hit the planet with a giant meteorite. That's it.
Well, we've got Bruce Willis. He can go out there and drill a hole in it.
I think we should blast him into space just in case.
Blow it up, yeah. So what kind of things are you researching at the moment?
At the moment, amongst the things I'm looking at, I'm particularly interested in the sort of aftermath of this PT extinction, the sort of the 5 million years afterwards, from about 252 to 247 million years ago. We think it's probably incredibly hot. In fact, probably the hottest the world has ever got. It's just a real super greenhouse climate in the aftermath of this mass extinction.
So what kind of temperatures are we talking?
We have a nice record of sea surface temperatures, which we can get from analysing little bits of bone. And we think that equatorial sea surface temperatures peaked at 40 degrees centigrade. Now, to put that temperature in context, that's the temperature of hot soup. So, or it's the sort of temperature that if you were to take a shower, if 40, you could probably just about manage at 40 degrees. You might just want to turn it down a notch.
Sound that high. 40 degrees? Is that what temperature your shower is?
According to my temperature dial on the shower, yeah. It's about shower temperature, I guess. But the thing about this temperature is this is the annual average sea surface temperature.
Right.
So you will put it in context. The hottest ocean waters today around sort of the Middle East and around the Sinai and so on are 28 degrees C is the average sea surface temperatures today. And we don't think there have been many times when the temperatures have exceeded 30 degrees in equatorial waters. And so this is sort of off the scale almost. It's just incredibly hot. And it has a whole series of consequences for life as well. It becomes very hard to live at that temperature. So have you ever been... I guess have you ever lived, walked? I
mean, I've been to hot places.
I was going to say, you go to hot places, asking, yes. Yeah. I mean, if you went on holiday to Las Vegas, for example, and then sort of wandered around Las Vegas in the height of summer, you'll have temperatures in the low 40s almost certainly, which is very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And what actually your body starts doing in those temperatures, because your proteins start to denature when you get to about high 30s, low 40s. And start to unravel, basically. And so your body starts to produce heat shock proteins, which are there to stop you from essentially slowly cooking. And so if you spend too long in that, your body starts to spend a lot of its metabolic energy doing that. You start to feel lethargic and tired. And if you spend weeks, months, and so on at that temperature, you'll eventually die at that temperature. So you can't suffer that temperature all year round. It's not good. There's a few lizards in the desert can operate at temperatures in the sort of mid-40s, but most things don't make it much beyond that. Photosynthesis actually is even harder. For plants, a lot of plants start photorespirating, but they stop photosynthesizing when you start to approach 40 degrees C. So in fact, for a lot of animals, even if you can survive at that temperature, you start to run out of things to eat. Because the plants aren't surviving at that temperature. I think about having a hot bath now. You don't sit in a hot bath for too long with your heat shock protein. So the consequence of this, I think, is that this is just at equatorial temperatures. We don't think, actually, that it was particularly bad at high latitudes, and things are actually doing much better at high latitudes at this time. But the equatorial waters and the equatorial sort of belt of the world at that time became uninhabitable for a lot of organisms. The organisms which suffer most are organisms like ourselves, highly active animals which need a lot of oxygen And that oxygen demand goes up with temperature, and it becomes harder and harder to be sort of effective as the temperatures go up.
So what are the factors stopping plants and animals acclimatizing to this temperature?
It is this problem of, it's at the sort of molecular level. You can't, I mean, you're in effect starting to cook. I mean, if you get to the high 40s, you are cooking, you will start to cook. And so you can't, certainly for animals, it becomes less and less viable because you're spending more and more time just stopping your proteins from breaking down and not being an animal and using your energy for other things like reproducing and going looking for food and things like that. So it becomes just not viable to be an active animal at high temperatures, at very high temperatures like this. There is a limit. I mean, if you think about, I mean, there's a lower limit to life, but there is an upper limit to life as well, and it is between sort of 40 and 50 is the upper limit to life. It's interesting that some of the groups that do are fine at this are those that have been around a long time. The cyanobacteria can actually, these are blue-green algae, they photosynthesize as well, and they were the first group to evolve billions of years ago photosynthesizing. They can survive at temperatures up to and beyond 70 degrees C. They're incredibly tough, which is probably a sort of a legacy of the fact that that's the sort of world they evolved into, and so they still have that ability. But our more modern plants are not, they've never encountered temperatures like this, and so are not adapted to them.
So we're really lumbered with the...
What am I trying to say? We're stuck with
our temperature range.
Really. We are. I think life in the sea in particular has never really encounters temperatures above 28 degrees C, and so has no real need to evolve strategies to cope with high temperatures because it doesn't do that. These are average annual temperatures. Everything can cope with temperatures beyond its normal conditions for short amounts of time. But yeah, if the sea is on average 40 degrees C, then in summer it might have approached 50 degrees C, which is terrible. And in winters it might go down to sort of low 30s. So you've got a temperature range, but it's when the average gets so high that you're in trouble.
So which animals survive the high temperature as well?
We know things like cyanobacteria can survive perfectly well in hot conditions. And there are a few groups which seem to do pretty well, actually. Snails, for example, for reasons I don't know, but understand. But snails actually can do quite well around hot springs, for example, in sort of volcanic hot springs. Will often have their own sort of unique species of snail, which is adapted to those hot waters, and they'll be really hot waters. And so they seem, as a group, able to quite tolerate that. And it's actually interesting, after the End Permian extinction, that snails do really well. We have a lot of little tiny snails all over the world at this time, so the snails seem to benefit from, or at least their ability to tolerate high temperatures seems to have been a good benefit to them in the early Triassic.
I want to be a snail.
I want to be a mushroom.
We'd both survive together.
Yeah. All the way into the future. Although apparently there's hope. We're ruining the planet, but not as much as we thought.
Yeah, it could be a lot worse, but then again, we don't know how many meteorites or comets are going to hit.
True.
But as we said, there's always Bruce Willis. He can save us. What happened in the other film? Because there were two, weren't they, that came out at exactly the same time?
Don't know.
There was Deep Impact and Armageddon.
Oh, yeah. Deep Impact, it hits the planet and there's a massive tidal wave.
Were there loads of gastropods and fungus?
I think it ends on the massive tidal wave.
Were there Lystrosauruses?
Yeah, loads.
Yeah, sounds about right. Well, if you've enjoyed the episode, please share it. If you know anyone who might be interested, there's a lot of interesting points came up about climate change and the future, if there might be another mass extinction. So I've really enjoyed this episode, and I hope you have too.
And we will see you all next time for another thrilling episode of your favourite paleontology podcast. Bye!
Hey, Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating and Laura Soule. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.